we're the quickest form of government there is. You call three numbers. Where are you? What's going on? And a fire truck shows up.
This is not a test. MUSC Health's Emergency Management and Disaster Preparedness Podcast, designed for your busy life, arming you with the knowledge and skills when faced with uncertainty.
And this is not a test, MUSC's first Emergency Management and Disaster Preparedness Podcast. I'm Eric Madrinsky, the Ambulatory Emergency Manager, joined here by Brian Wood, our Lieutenant of Public Safety and University Emergency Manager, and our very special guest today, Chief Mike Kennedy from Ann Arbor City Fire Department. Mike, thanks for joining us.
I've known you for many years, so like we said in the past, we're not going to share any stories because it would be mutually assured destruction, so we'll just leave it at that. But tell us how you got into the fire service, why you got into the fire service, and where you're at now.
I actually hit my 30th year in the fire service in 2024. So something that was always a interest just as a kid. Don't really have the family legacy that some other folks do. I had an uncle that was an on-call firefighter, but they lived quite a ways away from us. So a little familiar with it, but definitely not like father or grandfather type lineage. The big thing for me is that the community I grew up in Brighton, Michigan, had at the time they called it a junior program, and it was basically for high school kids. And got into that beginning of my sophomore year in high school and was hooked. So did that throughout high school. Actually was able to go in and get basic fire training. Fortunately, had very good guidance from my parents, and I did well academically in high school. And they're like, hey, if you want to do the fire thing, that's great. But I think they were thinking it was something I was going to grow out of. And also, as I think most parents, kind of concerned that if injury and things such as that. So they were very strong on, hey, get a college degree. And I think they also felt that at that point, any poor decisions I made weren't on them. So they could say,
right.
they checked the parent box. I wasn't in jail. Their whatever decisions I make at that point don't reflect on them. So I went and got a four-year degree from the University of Michigan. And also during that time, got my paramedic. Because in the 90s, it was very competitive to get fire jobs in Michigan. It has changed dramatically since then. So then worked for several kind of career departments, a pretty non-traditional career. A lot of most firefighters work for a city or county department, do their 20, 25, 30 years, get a pension, and then might go to another department or something else. I jumped around quite a bit for better or worse. I was able to get into some positions at a very young age. But my financial planner would would say that wasn't the best. If I could go back to 20-year-old self, it'd probably be, hey, stick somewhere, get a pension, and then move from there. Kind of my where I'm at currently really set the stage in 2010. I was working, or I got a job with the University of Michigan doing emergency management, and also concurrently was a chief of a small, much smaller community, just over 10,000 population in Metro Detroit. So really had two full-time jobs at the same time. The fire chief job was considered part-time, but there's really no such thing as a part-time fire chief. So did that for 7 years concurrently, and then landed my current spot, which is the fire chief of the city of Ann Arbor. So I've been here just over 7 years now. And yeah, it's been something that if you would have asked, I think myself or others 30 years ago, if I would have ended up here, I don't think any of us would have had this on our bingo cards. So
how big is your department, Mike?
So our department we're budgeted for just under 90 FTEs. Emergency management is two civilian positions that are under the fire department. So that's citywide emergency management. And then in operations, we only have 72 budgeted for that. Our daily assigned staffing is 24, but we'll go down to an 18 minimum. So that's six companies assigned out of five stations. So comparatively, because we don't do EMS transport, we have a lower FTE staffing than a lot of other kind of similar departments in Michigan or regionally. As we get into the transport business, we'll kind of have to see how that progresses. It's a challenge of how we're going to add staffing to potentially increase our transport capability. A challenge for us, though, is Ann Arbor is, we really are a bit outside of the more dense Metro Detroit area. So the departments that surround us get much smaller very quickly. So a lot of them only have two people on a rig and maybe only six people on duty. And they really struggle with just doing their day-to-day call volume. So we don't have a big peer city to call for help right away. If we were to get into something substantial, it's probably going to be a half hour before we really get significant reinforcements. And that's coming from another county. And as with all departments, everybody struggles just to do medicals on a Wednesday morning. So then you throw that into it. It has an impact to us, especially during game day operations, would have a true regional impact. But we would be on our own for quite a while.
So what does a typical day for Ann Arbor City Fire Department look like?
We do have some pretty dramatic different times of year. So when school is in session, again, the resident population is about 130,000. We struggle with counting that student population. So when school's in session, we estimate easily that number is closer to 200, if not 250,000. And we do notice a little bit of a decrease of calls for service in the summer when school's not in session. We deal with a lot of challenges that kind of a community that has an urban core to it, a lot of unhoused population, people dealing with substance abuse or mental health issues. So for our downtown station, they are very routinely responding to people in crisis. We do have the only county shelter for an unhoused population. So we're generally at the shelter two, three times, if not double, triple that a day for people in crisis. So we deal with a lot of those similar kind of urban issues. And what's interesting for Ann Arbor is you go across the country and in a city of 130,000, 200,000 generally isn't considered a very big city. We're certainly not kind of that metropolitan standard. For the state of Michigan, though, we're the fifth biggest city. And the other part is that we're a very dense city. As I look out my office window as we're doing this podcast, we have seven sky cranes in our city. We are the fastest growing vertical city in the entire state of Michigan. And we have more vertical construction going on in Ann Arbor than the city of Detroit. So we're dealing with some very significant, very rapid vertical growth, which has really challenged us on the fire service side, because our department is really staffed and operationally deployed for single family house fires, 1,200 square foot single family dwelling. We can do that all day. You all of a sudden have a kitchen fire on the 15th floor of a student high rise. That not only immediately drains all of our on-duty resources, but starts to really have an impact on a big chunk of our county. So that's a policy level issue that we're having current conversations with our electeds about, of, hey, how do we address this vertical challenge? And some of that's been neat too. We've really worked with a lot of kind of national fire service leaders from Denver, Chicago, and even international with Toronto, of bringing some of these outside leaders, because our department just does not have this historical legacy of dealing with high-rise fires. And when you're fighting a fire off of a standpipe, that's completely different than pulling a hose line off a engine parked out front. And there, it just really comes down to staffing. These are very staffing, labor-intensive fires, and a whole lot of things need to get done concurrent with one another. So That's been a huge issue for us as a department and organizationally, from an equipment and staffing perspective of dealing with that vertical challenge. So with that, also dealing with elevator emergencies, we used to maybe do one or two a month. Now we're doing one or two a week, sometimes one or two a day. So that's a whole other challenge of that expertise of dealing with elevator systems. So our department is definitely not stagnant by any stretch. Those are just some of the day-to-day challenges that we're dealing with.
So, Mike, for our audience that might not know, what are some of the big challenges, like the big house in Ann Arbor, in the emergency services?
Yeah, so the city of Ann Arbor, we have a resident population of just under 130,000. Ann Arbor's really most notable for the University of Michigan, and we're just west of the city of Detroit. So most of Southeast Michigan, Metro Detroit, is really driven by the automotive industry. What's interesting is Ann Arbor has almost zero manufacturing. It is a company town, but that company is the University of Michigan. I think last year was close to $2 billion in research. We'll see with the new administration at the federal level if that what may happen to that, but it's one of those, but for the university, the city of Ann Arbor, and but for the city of Ann Arbor, the University of Michigan. It's been described as a marriage where neither, a marriage where neither can get divorced. Again, the economics of our city are directly tied to the university. Total enrollment, I think, is in the, 50,000 right now. For their Ann Arbor campus. They do have two other satellite campuses that are kind of more function as regional community colleges, but the main University of Michigan is Ann Arbor. And then they also operate a very large hospital system. So they're the a region-wide level one adult trauma in pediatric hospital system, operate their own air ambulance service. And then that's just the day to day. So we've got our 130,000 people that are residents, and then we're still kind of trying to figure out post COVID what those numbers are like. But easy math is that our population gets well above 200,000 during the weekday when school's in session, with everyone coming for healthcare as part of the health system, and then just all the support services that go along with that university system. What's also a challenge for us too is a lot of universities are more congruent, where such as like Michigan State, they're our kind of big in-state rival. They have a very congruent defined campus. Penn State, similar, where you kind of have city and then you have university, and it's a very clear line. University is in the middle of our downtown, and so you could go block to block and it's city property, university building. In the state of Michigan, the public universities have a board of governors, and that's the way University of Michigan is structured. So they're almost, or I shouldn't say almost, they are an independent government agency. But what's interesting is that from a city side, the things that they are 100% dependent on the city for is water, so clean water in, dirty water out, and fire protection. So for the fire service, when there's a fire on campus, we're really the one time where the city kind of has that authority having jurisdiction during a fire type emergency. Otherwise, the university has its own police department, utilities, road, transportation, pretty much everything you would find in a large or mid-sized city, they have, except for a fire department. So that creates kind of a unique dynamic of interdependency between the two. So on a day-to-day basis, it's challenging. And then you throw in 7-8 times a year, the Michigan Stadium, which right now is the largest stadium in the United States outside of NASCAR. NASCAR has higher capacity, but in terms of what you would consider a traditional stadium, it's Michigan Stadium, and their occupancy counts right at 109. We just got word last week that they're going to do their first nighttime concert ever at the stadium. So that's thrown us a bit into a tailspin for planning for that. Zach Bryan is coming the end of September. And so we're now dealing with a country concert that they haven't had before there. So that then absolutely doubles our city population when we have that influx. And it's not just the game itself, but it's the tailgating several hours before and all the either celebration or drowning of sorrows several hours after. So
how do you prepare for that, right? There's so many aspects. You have the medical portion of it. So you have people getting sick and needing medical support, the fire aspect, crowd control. How do you guys prepare for something so big? Let's take either a football game or the concert.
So credit to the university. They have their own emergency management program. So they really take kind of the lead planning efforts. And it's truly a year-round planning effort for that. And as you mentioned, there's so many different aspects to it. We do a lot of training, planning, exercising. One issue that we're dealing with now is actually air monitoring. So you have 100,000 people in such a confined space. The threat of some sort of more of a state actor doing a chemical attack was something more in the post 9/11 era. So we're really having that exercise now of is that still a threat that we need to be prepared for? And what does that monitoring look like? What sort of plans and contingencies are we going to have in place for that? Because unfortunately, as we've seen across the country, just getting a car and ramming it into a crowd can have a pretty significant impact and doesn't cost near the amount of money. So making sure, because it's real easy to add stuff to keep saying, hey, we're going to do all this stuff. But at what point do we say, okay, that's not something that we need to deal with, that was a threat of a generation ago. And none of these are easy decisions to deal with. What we've tried to focus on is it doesn't really matter what causes the impact. It's more, okay, we had X happen. Now we have this mass casualty incident, and how are we going to deal with that? The stadium is not very close to a freeway, so we're about a mile and a half north of the nearest freeway. There's several local streets to get to the trauma center. There's really not a great thoroughfare to get to that, and our single hospital could easily be overwhelmed. And I mean, quick math, if you have 100,000 people and there's a 1% success rate, well, that's a thousand casualties. And there's not really a system across the country that is not going to struggle with 1,000 casualties. So again, whether that's a deliberate attack, that's a bad actor, whether that's again, even if it was a person who was drunk driving and hopped a curb and went into a crowd of people. Well, we might have 24 casualties from that. So really trying to almost decouple what causes it versus us having to deal with the consequence management of that. We have a separate EMS partner in the city. So they do a tremendous amount of staffing at the stadium itself. In the last year, we've gotten into the basic life support transport business, just as across the country, our third-party ambulance provider has struggled with hiring and retention. So that's something that we've had to add. So we'll upstaff ambulances for that day and been working with the hospital system to make sure that they have contingencies in place to deal with that excess of patients. Because, again, even on a game day, we're going to – everyone is going to be busier. We generally average around 40 to 50 incidents a day on a home game with nice weather against one of our major rivals. We'll easily double our call volume across the city. So it's also too, not just the stadium footprint, but that citywide impact.
So talk about your incident command system or your incident command center. What does that look like?
So the University of Michigan does have its own emergency operations center. The city of Ann Arbor does have one too that we've actually just stood up this calendar year in early 2025. But for the University of Michigan, it's been about a decade now that they redid it. It was dedicated space, or it's a dedicated EOC now. They did not have that luxury before. That was actually one of the last projects I worked on when I was still with U of M. So some traditional EOCs will kind of get into the logistics planning, more of those traditional NIMS phases. It's much more operational, and to the credit of all the partner agencies that are involved with that, it's really set up that the bad things already happened. So we're not waiting for there to be an incident. That EOC is structured where all the right players are already there. So during game days, there's a unified command with the university has its own police chief. There's the city police chief, myself, and then the local FBI office also has a rep there. So the four of us really are part of that unified command as part of just normal game day operations, that we're in that ready position. And we're kind of at a part of a separate part of the EOC. And then there's kind of an inner group, if you will, that deals with more of that kind of tactical management of, hey, a fire alarm came in or medical came in, or there's a drone incursion. And they're dealing with more kind of the routine incidents, if you will. And then us with that unified command team would be something more significant were to happen, that we're having to kind of make some policy decisions. It's also working with university athletics. Anytime, obviously, all of our games are going to be live broadcast. So there's issues of if the team's on the field, then the crowd's not going to do anything. And we've learned that through several weather events. So if we were to deal with a weather evacuation due to weather, either lightning or a tornado, we would we'd have to work with athletics on that, but we know the crowd's not going to evacuate if the team's on the field. So that EOC has close to 30 people in it, local, county, University of Michigan. Our state police has a very large contingency of troopers that are brought in. So it's I know for the law enforcement alone, it's between 250 officers alone are there, and then you add fire and EMS resources, we're closer to that 350 number in terms of first responders.
I think it's interesting you talked about, for example, if the team's on the field, nobody's doing anything in the crowd. So that's something that you've learned. So one of the things I think about, you have 50,000 people, 60,000 people coming to the game, somebody calls 911 and says, hey, I need help. How do you find that person? Like, what's the, you know, where do you send people even to help them? And some of them being maybe not of clear mind and judgment at the time.
Correct. Yeah. The so that wayfinding is a huge struggle for us. The 911 call. So from if someone's calling from a cell phone, that goes to a countywide 911 center that's operated by our sheriff's office, and then that'll get transferred. The university does operate its own secondary PSAP, but they don't take any direct 911 calls. So fortunately, in and around the stadium, they have a tremendous camera network. So we're, and a lot of this is just kind of experience of the call takers, of people trying to describe where they're at. If they're on University of Michigan property, there's a good chance we're going to be able to pull up a camera feed and try to zero in on a location to send responders. The struggle is basically to the south, southwest, and west is all city property. And on the south side are actually two golf courses that do several hundred vehicles for tailgating. And that becomes a huge struggle for us, is not only the access to get a EMS resource or a fire resources to where they're at, because fire engines and golf courses don't exactly go well together. So we have a Polaris fire unit that we can use if there's a car fire, maybe a grill got tipped over and started a small fire. And then similarly, EMS uses Gator units, John Deere Gator units to get around as well, realizing that, again, trying to get an ambulance or fire truck into those areas aren't going to work. About a decade ago, too, the university has worked on using feather flags, and we got that from another Big Ten school. And they're color-coded along with letters and symbols. So if somebody's at least can tell us, hey, I'm by an orange flag, then we know there's a certain group of parking that has the orange flags. And if they can tell us, okay, it's S3, then we know that was the State Street entrance. We can narrow in that way. So those flags have been very helpful. Sometimes it's a very large deployment of personnel. This last season, we started using drones significant more, and that has been an absolute game changer in terms of us trying to get eyes on the sky for deployment. When the football team won the national championship just over a year ago, we were able to actually get a live feed from our state police helicopter. We had about two dozen celebratory fires, and we were actually able to dispatch fire resources. We didn't get a single 911 call on any of those fires because the helicopter was able to use FLIR, that infrared. And so basically the second a fire lit off, we had four deployed fire resources, and it was pretty cool. And we could tell the students were getting a little annoyed because basically the second they set a couch on fire, we had a fire engine pulling onto the block.
Oh, come on.
You're ruining the party here.
We're going to roast the marshmallows at, you know?
Yeah. And I think they kind of quickly learned that hey, as fast as they were lighting them, we were arriving on scene. So we dealt with that for about 2 hours, and then I think they kind of gave up. So, but that was just really us having those fire resources pre-staged, and then just utilizing that technology and again bringing in that state police helicopter and having that live feed. It was just absolutely huge for us, and it also prevented too crowds gathering, and then it kind of becomes that. But rules don't apply mentality, and then all of a sudden a car's on its side and all that other stuff. Us being able to get there, put the fire out before a crowd even amassed, it kind of took the wind out of their sails, if you will. So our big in-state rival is Michigan State, and our big Big Ten rival is Ohio State University. So we automatically know that for those games, like that's kind of a next level. And we have always made sure we've had air assets. It's always been the state police helicopter historically, but this last season we've integrated that drone technology. And when I say we, I need to clarify just for some political reasons. It's the University of Michigan using that drone technology on their campus. We have been using the helicopter technology off campus. We're still working through some local political sensitivities of drones and civil rights concerns with our local police department. So we hope to hopefully have a City of Ann Arbor drone program online in calendar 25. But again, need to make sure that our elected officials and our local residents are have a level of comfort that it's not going to be used inappropriately. And obviously there's kind of some national sentiment on maybe police overreach or surveillance state, which certainly is not our intention, but we need to make sure that we're addressing those political concerns as we go along.
That's really cool. Drones are awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, they kind of got a little bad name right now floating around out there, but you know, I mean,
yeah,
huge tool.
So FDNY in New York City really took the lead with drones and firefighting, and they do an incredible job. I'm just bragging on New York City for a little bit.
It's all good.
No, and interestingly, our county hazmat team has had them for a couple years now, and we have actually used them in our – we've actually had to activate the hazmat team to use them for missing persons. So we have been using them. It just hasn't been really kind of owned and operated by city public safety departments. So again, missing persons. The police department's looked for them for suspects that have kind of maybe crashed a car from a pursuit and then have that fled. We've had a couple. We had a chemical get into our city sewer system that discharges into a very large river that goes through the city, and so we had a sheen on the river, and we were actually able to identify the discharge port from the storm water of where it was coming from, and that allowed us to kind of concentrate diking and filter activities around that discharge port. That was very helpful for us. So yeah, certainly no question the value and the different things that they can be used for is again truly a game changer of us being able to provide service to our community.
So question, I mean, you have obviously tons of growth like you just spoke to, and you know, for your staff, how do you keep morale up for your firemen and your staff that work for you? How does that something in leadership, like what do you do to keep that up, or what are you thinking about doing?
I think if I had an answer to the how to keep firefighters happy question, I could probably travel around the country and
same name, thing on the police side.
We'd buy that book.
Exact same thing.
We would buy that book.
We thought you guys were all happy. How is that?
So yeah. The thing is, Mike, is we got you on a podcast trying to get the answers from you.
Certainly, I mean, that's a daily struggle. One thing that I will say, and it's a credit to the residents of our city and our city leadership, we have one of the better contracts in the state of Michigan. Obviously, the state of Michigan with heavy automotive industry is a very labor-friendly state. They have collective bargaining. They have arbitration. So some states, and I think where you all are located, it's there might be unions, but there's not a whole lot of teeth behind some of the bargaining power of those unions. Very much the opposite in Michigan, where the unions are have a very strong legal authority. And certainly there's always a balance there of kind of where thoughts of where the union wants things and our really budget constraints. And I mean, we certainly share the same idea that I would love to have more firefighters and more staffing, but I also have a budget that I'm bound to. So how I then work to advocate for our department with our policymakers and those that give us our funding every year to eventually increase that. And that's certainly a process and something that takes years of planning to be able to do that. And a challenge we deal with in the fire service is as much as we value each and individual firefighter, if our city gives us one firefighter position, it really doesn't do anything to our operation because firefighters are deployed in teams. So as part of our collective bargaining agreement, if I'm going to add an additional fire unit, if let's say I want to add a high-rise unit, which is what we're currently advocating for, well, that's 12 positions with a lieutenant, a driver, and two firefighters with a daily minimum staffing of three. So it's easy to say, hard to do. That's a bit of a challenge for us. So
we as cops always thought you firemen are all happy and you don't need to worry about morale.
We've really revamped our whole training department. Obviously, this podcast is part of it. Life skills training, for example, fire safety. When's the last time you heard somebody injured or died in a clinic fire somewhere? It doesn't happen, right? So the trainings that we do are life skills training. We should be doing fire safety and fire preparedness training at home, right? And the thought process is if you're safe at home, you have good habits at home, you're bringing that to work. And ultimately, our care team members are coming to work and not getting hurt at home. So how do you prepare your community?
So we certainly strive to do a lot of community outreach. Obviously, kind of with the fire service, the fall is a key time that we focus on that. We don't have kind of dedicated staff to do community outreach. That is a longer term budget request for us. So that's primarily done through our on-duty companies with a lot of focus on school-age kids. We do have a assistant chief that we've worked upon with really trying to target a lot of our frequent callers. And we realize what a large percentage of our responses are to, we have a lot of occupancies that are subsidized housing. And certainly we have a very disparate amount of calls to a very few amount of addresses. And a lot of it's from kind of occupant behavior of cooking issues or other sorts of behavior that's causing a fire department response. So we've really tried, that's been a target of us, of really trying to use an approach to use data, look at the addresses we're going to. And you had kind of a prior question on that firefighter morale. I think a large source of constant frustration, especially for a department that deals with dense urban issues, are going on calls for help that these people need assistance, but they generally don't need a fire truck. However, we're the quickest form of government there is. You call three numbers, where are you, what's going on, and a fire truck shows up. So trying to work with these individuals to get them more community resources. A lot of the times it's some of our mental health partners. So we have had some success with that. And that's been a little bit more of a focus than that kind of community-wide approach to things. Ann Arbor, fortunately, is overall a pretty affluent community, and a lot of that's driven by that University of Michigan. An interesting fact of ours is that half of the residential units are rentals, and our city has a very strong and robust rental inspection program. So if you're going to rent out a house, it's going to get inspected on an annual basis. So making sure working smoke detectors, carbon monoxide detectors. So a lot of our housing stock, we've got a city inspector in there annually, which is, I know is having a direct impact on fire incidents that we have. So in terms of keeping those incidents down. So kind of a long question or long answer, but I hopefully address the question a little bit.
What's one of the most important leadership lessons you've learned, either in your past careers here at City of Ann Arbor?
Great question. I had a former city administrator who I report to talked about needing to respond and not react. And certainly a lot of what my current position as fire chief is not doing the tactical stuff, but doing the labor management, HR issues, budget issues. Certainly it can feel real good to type a spicy email, but generally kind of get into the employee morale side of things, that doesn't solve a whole lot. So needing to, again, take that breath, sleep on something. I've been fortunate. I've had a very strong group of other fire chiefs to lean to, because that is tough, is once you get to those leadership positions, needing to turn to people in other organizations that are dealing with similar issues. And that is something too, that as you talk with people outside of your own agency, you realize that, hey, they're dealing with similar things. Change the names, might have a little bit different flavor to something, but overall, big picture, a lot of the similar issues. And so being able to kind of consult with them and having a group of people that can tell you, hey, no, you're being an idiot. Like you need those people that are willing to give you direct, honest feedback, and being able to realize, like, hey, that was I could have handled that a lot better. And I always try to reflect on things. And there's definitely several times a week where I'm like, well, that maybe wasn't my best self at that moment, and trying to do better. And it's a constant challenge there. But I think being able to solicit feedback and then receive that feedback is probably one of the better and bigger lessons that I've learned throughout my career. So,
yeah, fair enough. I had my old mentor / boss here at MUSC. She always said, when you're going to send back a spicy email, if it feels good, probably shouldn't send it.
24 out.
You gotta,
and they can feel really good.
Yeah. I mean, exactly.
24-hour rule.
Yeah, 24. Just type it. Don't put anything. And just let it sit for 24 hours.
I learned that the hard way.
Mike, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. And just like all of our guests, you get the last word.
Honored to be asked to be part of this, and owe a debt of gratitude to all the people that have helped me get to where I am. And for everyone that's in this field, just know that we're simply placeholders, and we owe the gratitude to those that came before us, and to make it a little bit better for those that'll follow us. So thank you again.
Excellent. Wow,
that was good.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Be safe out there. And this is Not a Test, MUSC's first emergency management and disaster preparedness podcast. I'm Eric Madrinsky.
And I'm Brian Wood.
This is Not a Test. Preparedness is a mindset.